Hello and welcome to Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan. Thank you for joining us once again and welcome back to the show. We're in season 11 now. It's just a bit mad really, isn't it?
It is crazy, yeah. But I was listening to a podcast earlier today and he's done over 1,000 episodes.
Wow.
So I thought, well, that surely has got to be a target for us if people will still have us as we get towards that.
I hope they will.
Only be another 10 years or so.
How many episodes do you think we have actually done then?
It's hard, isn't it? Because
I think it says something like, or something.
Yeah, it's something 270 something, but some of those episodes weren't proper episodes.
And then some of the episodes we've taken off and moved around as
we
well.
We did. So. We had to, yeah, for legal reasons.
For legal reasons.
I think we're only a few weeks off our 300th episode.
That's really exciting. It's impossible to imagine how families continue on in the days and weeks following a violent tragedy. But to then discover that there were opportunities for people to potentially prevent this from happening, well, that must be so much harder to wrap your head around. Often the phrase "the wrong place at the wrong time" is used, and it's a phrase I really don't like to use, but it is an expression that kind of speaks for the randomness of life and that sometimes people happen to be somewhere, and if they'd been there 10 minutes earlier or 10 minutes later, the outcome may well have been different. And we have covered many cases that have been truly random, haven't we, Mark?
We have, yeah. I think that's what makes it alarming, isn't it? Extra alarming, because I always say we all take precautions in our day-to-day lives to try and mitigate risks. That's normal. We do that. We wear a seatbelt when we go in the car, for example. We try and stick to the speed limits, that sort of thing. So there's lots of things where we do try and mitigate risk and we think we're being as responsible as we possibly can, but you can't mitigate the risk of everything. So I think that's what really brings it home when we cover those cases where a cruel twist of fate has resulted in somebody's life being taken from them. I think, it just makes you think, actually, this could happen to any of us. And that's why it's all the more shocking.
Yeah. But on the flip side, when it comes out that there were opportunities for people in positions of trust or positions of power to prevent something from happening, suddenly it feels less like the wrong place at the wrong time. And in fact, it was wholly inevitable that someone was going to die.
Before we begin, let's say a huge thank you to our newest Patreon supporters.
Would you like to do the honours, Mark?
I will, yeah, because there's only three this time, so I think I can cope. So we have Sharon Chan, Daisy Horton and Reese Kershaw.
Thank you.
Thank you to each and every one of you, and thank you to all of our existing Patreon supporters. If you would like to join them, all you need to do is head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast and we'll see you there for lots of bonus content.
It was early morning when police officers from the Derbyshire Constabulary attended reports of a disturbance. They were dispatched when a 999 call was made by a man stating he needed an ambulance and that he had killed four people, and the police arrived on scene 14 minutes after this first phone call. There had also been another 999 call made reporting an issue at the residence by the suspect's mother. She was calling because she was worried because he told her that he'd stabbed himself. And when the police arrived, the man was waiting outside the property. He had sort of superficial wounds to his chest and his stomach. And body cam footage of the officers arriving at about 7:25 in the morning of the 19th of September 2021 shows him calmly replying to their questions. The footage has been released by the police and it includes the following, and I'm going to get Mark to act out the male parts in this for me.
Suspect. Basically, I need the following bit is inaudible in the ambulance, and that because I've killed four people. Officer. All right, have you got anything on you that you shouldn't have? No, there's no weapons or anything. Have you armed yourself? Have you stabbed yourself, mate? You can see blood in your hands. Suspect. Yeah, just my chest. 4 inches in with a bread knife and one on the stomach.
The whole thing was very calm. The man unbuttoned his coat to show the officers his wounds and he took it off, revealing a football top. And the suspect also states on the footage,
I don't know why, it was like I was outside my body looking in. Massive head wounds, they are gone. They are all gone.
We also see and hear the officer radioing back to base about what they've attended, and I don't think they quite believed when the suspect was stating he'd killed four people. He was so calm, he didn't seem majorly injured. The interaction continued, and you hear the officer say to his radio,
It's Sunday, four people. He's been calm and compliant, but he's got some stab wounds to his chest and they're not oozing blood, but he's saying that his family are inside and that he believes he has murdered them. Are you all right for me to go in?
And the suspect's most chilling statement caught on the body cam footage was,
I know what's going to happen. I'm going to go to prison, obviously, again. I've murdered 4 people.
The officers handcuffed the suspect and sat him down on the floor against the wall as they prepared to enter the home to investigate. What they would find inside was beyond their worst nightmares and resulted in them arresting their suspect, handcuffing him and putting him into the police van because he was telling the truth. He was absolutely responsible for 4 murders. So the property that we've been discussing was on Chandos Crescent, which is close to Killamarsh town centre, which is in Derbyshire, here in the UK. Killamarsh is close to Sheffield, Chesterfield and Rotherham, and it was first recorded way back in 1086 in the Domesday Book, which I always find weird and crazy. With a population of just under 10,000 people, Killamarsh has a real community spirit and a busy village centre for shopping, and the council proudly advertises the good local transport links and beautiful views of the Rother Valley Country Park. Of course, there are also the usual walking and cycling routes advertised. Photos show the beautiful rolling hills. I think it's those kind of green rolling hills that we all think of when imagining England, that green and pleasant land. It's that sort of vibe.
I don't think I've ever been to Derbyshire, but it's where the Peak District is, isn't it? I think. I'm hoping so.
I'm keeping quiet because I've got no idea.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And it is supposed to be a beautiful county. There's lots of small villages and towns. And yeah, a bit like how the Cotswolds is, but probably a bit more lush and green, I would have thought, because it's a bit further north.
And it's a little bit more vast, in kind of my opinion of it, compared with the Cotswolds, yeah. Google Street View images of Chandos Crescent show what looks like a really normal and quite nice looking area. There's lots of open spaces surrounding the suburban street. You could imagine if you walked your dog there, you've got a couple of green areas that you can go and carry on walking on once you get off the roads. It's really quite standard for a lot of the UK, but it's very nice. And obviously houses where tragedies occur rarely look as though they'd hide such evil, but this is 100% that sort of area. It's obvious that this crime would have shocked and absolutely rocked the local community. The house itself was demolished in July 2023, a decision made by the local authorities, which was backed by the bereaved families and supported by the local community. And this house was a building with 2 houses attached to each other, so both properties were semi-detached. And the family from the other house on the property actually requested to be moved by the council to a new house after the murders. The entire building has been demolished and the ground has become part of the green space that was already alongside. So it's not there at all anymore.
I do find this a weird concept because the same thing happened with Fred and Rose West's house in Gloucester. So that was demolished and I think it was turned into, they didn't build another house there. I think it might be a kind of memorial garden or something. I might have made that up. But I don't know. I just sort of find it's almost trying to really erase that this happened. And I know that there's bad memories associated with that particular house. Maybe other people wouldn't want to live there in the future because of that. And I'm not saying I've never been in this position, so I might want to demolish the house if that happened to me. But I just find it a bit weird. Do you?
I kind of get it, though, because I think it may be a very different sort of scenario. So with the Wests, I think you're almost running the risk of people who glorify them or have some sort of weird obsession that they're actually going to go there. And that could in itself be not necessarily dangerous, but it could be worrying and it could be unsettling for everybody else who lives there. I think in this case, it was that they just didn't want to live next door, you know, in such close proximity to where something awful had happened. And because these were council properties where the council let them to people, I think that the council just made that decision that they'd rather not have anybody turn down the property or decide not to live there or want to move out because, I don't know, like, you never know, somebody might think it was haunted, I'm not sure, but I think people just felt so unsettled by this.
It's fair enough.
I don't think I'd want to live in a house if I knew that something really horrendous had happened. I think I'd constantly be thinking, what's that mark? Is it something I should be freaked out by? If I take up the carpets, am I going to see something I don't want to?
I think that's it's easy for me to say, yeah, I don't understand it. But then I think, would I want to live there?
Mm.
No, I don't think I would. I think I'd really feel that bad energy there.
Yeah. And a lot of people are empaths, aren't they? They do feel that energy.
Yeah. And I think with the West, I think part of the decision to demolish that was because they'd excavated the garden so much. And I think it had kind of fucked with the foundations and stuff. So it wasn't necessarily safe to
that
to keep
makes sense,
it
yeah.
standing. So, but we do see this with lots of crimes in this country. I just find it interesting. And I wonder if that happens abroad. Probably, because it's quite a natural, it is quite a natural reaction. But I just, it just seems so drastic. But equally, I'm not doing it down. I do understand it. It's just,
but
it
you're
a
right, it is incredibly drastic.
It is,
you know, when
yeah.
you see the images of this property being demolished, it's a huge thing. And even that in itself is quite a reminder. And then also the gap of the two homes is quite the reminder as well. I'm not sure. I haven't noted, so I may be remembering wrong, but I think there is a bit of a memorial or a plaque or something in this section of the green area now, just in memory of the four people that we're going to go on to discuss. So what led to the murders of four people? Who were they and who killed them? So the suspect who had phoned 999 was 32-year-old former cage fighter and drug and alcohol addict Damien Bendall. He had previous convictions for crimes including robbery, attempted robbery, grievous bodily harm, and at the time of this, he was serving a 17-month suspended sentence for arson. So the suspended sentence included the use of an electronic tag to enforce a curfew on Bendall. And the officers found inside the home 35-year-old Terry Harris, Bendall's pregnant girlfriend, her two children, John Paul and Lacey, and Lacey's friend, Connie. John Paul was 13 years old and Lacey and Connie were both 11 years old. Connie had come round the night before for a sleepover to spend time with her friend, and it was the weekend. So on the Saturday she'd come round, it was just like any other day to begin with. They were off school. John Paul was in the house, and so were Lacey and Connie, and the girls were having this sleepover together. But Bendall, for some reason, flipped. So it's about 9:40 p.m. From records of text messages and phone calls. As the children were getting ready for bed, John Paul was preparing to have a shower. Bendall, who'd been smoking weed, taking cocaine, and some people have said that he was doing spice as well, but I haven't seen definitive proof of that. I just know that it's been mentioned a lot. He was on the phone attempting to get hold of cocaine from his drug dealer. And we don't know what happened, what kind of follows in detail, because Bendall maintains he's got no memory of the attacks. But what we do know is that Bendall grabbed a claw hammer and attacked all four of the people in the home that night. They had no chance against their attacker, who was described as brutal and vicious and cruel in court, as he smashed in their skulls with the claw hammer. Terry was found in the master bedroom. She had suffered at least 9 blows and possibly more to her head. She was found with multiple blunt force injuries to her head and face and a severe fracturing of her skull. Connie was attacked and killed in another bedroom, and she was found face down in that room with multiple blunt force fractures to the back of her head. John Paul was attacked in the bathroom, and his naked body was found in the bathroom on the bathroom floor because he'd literally just been about to get into the shower when this happened. And Lacey had been attacked downstairs and then dragged upstairs to the master bedroom where her mother lay. Lacey had suffered a severe, massive brain injury with lacerations to her head and hemorrhaging to her eyes and her face, indicating that she also had a pressure applied to her neck, so with a possible ligature. And in a horrific addition to the already heinous crime, Lacey had survived 30 minutes to an hour after suffering her head injuries. She had been unconscious, but not yet dead, and Bendall had raped her whilst she died. Police found a mirror positioned in such a way that Bendall had probably been using the mirror to see what he was doing when he raped her. So the prosecution said at trial that the assumption was that this was a voyeuristic act, watching himself raping Lacey whilst she lay dying.
Oh my God. So is he Lacey's mum's boyfriend or her dad?
No, he's not the dad of John Paul and Lacey. He's the dad of the unborn baby, and he's boyfriend of Terry. But no, not their dad. In the early hours of the morning, Bendel then took John Paul's Xbox and sold it to get drugs in Sheffield before returning to the house. And he later said to police, "I bet you don't get 4 murders in Killamarsh, do you? Well, I mean 5, because my missus was having a baby." He knew what he'd done and he knew full well. Damien Bendel pleaded guilty to the 4 murders and the rape of a child under 13 and was sentenced to a whole life order in December 2022, meaning he will never be released from prison. And his defence said in court that Bendel maintains he has no recollection of the offending and his actions remain inexplicable and motiveless, but he feels genuine remorse.
What do you think? I know you're going to go on to talk about things that could have been done to stop this occurring in the first place, but do you buy into that he had no recollection?
I don't think that he has no recollection, but I don't think that it's impossible, because he had a drug abuse issue. He was taking drugs a lot and drinking a lot, so perhaps he'd got himself into such a state that actually maybe he knew what he was doing whilst he was doing it. And, you know, in his mind, it was the reaction he should be doing. You know, it obviously isn't to anybody normal, but at that point, but perhaps his brain has kind of shut down and tried to ignore everything that he's done, because it is just so horrendous. I just don't know.
It almost reads like cocaine-induced psychosis. So, you know, real toxic level of cocaine that is now manifesting as psychosis, and he's just flipped. But I mean, I obviously don't know, I'm no expert, but it's one of those things you're just desperately trying to make sense of it, because it's really hard to wrap your head around to understand why somebody could do this. And if you can find some kind of reason, it helps you, again, going back to what we said at the beginning of the episode, try and mitigate against that happening. But unfortunately, it's probably just somebody who, there's no logic there. We can't apply logic to the situation. You can't avoid somebody like that, because it's somebody who is unpredictable that can just flip and do this.
Yeah, and I will go on in a little bit. There's a couple of things that hint towards perhaps why this did happen in the way it happened, and how absolutely horrendous it went. You know, it went so bad so fast, but we just don't know for definite. And I think that is really, really hard. So, yeah. This is horrendous enough, but Terry's family and loved ones were frustratingly not entirely shocked that something had happened. They never would have imagined the horrors that took place, but they had felt uneasy about Bendel for quite a while. So Terry's mum, Angie, spoke at length to the press, saying how a light has gone out in our lives after the deaths of Terry and her daughter and her son. And she said, "Terry was just an amazing human. Everything about her was for her children. She did everything for her kids." But she also talked about how Bendel initially seemed charming when he and Terry started a relationship, but that her daughter's behaviour had begun to change. The pair had been together for a few months, I'm not sure for definite how many months, and Terry's mum said he was always with her. There wasn't a time that he wasn't with her. It was just constant. She started to change the way that she dressed and she was quieter. She's always been a tomboy, always, but when she started going out with him, it was tight shorts and low-cut tops and her hair was bright red. It was as if he was parading her around. And she also said to ITV News, "I told her I was scared for her, that maybe I'd get a phone call one day saying he'd beaten her up. She seemed to watch everything she said around him. He was trying to stop her from coming to see us, and her friends were messaging me saying, 'We don't hear from her anymore.' My girl wasn't my girl anymore. He was controlling her." Terry's mum said that Bendel was a master manipulator, and she also said that her suspicions about Bendel had actually prompted her to consider using the domestic violence disclosure scheme, so known as Claire's Law, named after Claire Wood, who was murdered by her ex-boyfriend in 2009. And I know we've discussed this case before on the show, but a brief overview of this is that it's a scheme set up to let people find out whether or not their new partner or their partner has a history of domestic violence, so you can request that information from the police. However, Angie changed her mind about using the scheme because she was worried that the police would send their response to her daughter and Bendel might find out. And when she kind of realised the answers are sent to the person in the relationship, not the person requesting the information, she decided not to go through with the request. And she said to the press, "I realised that the information would probably go to my daughter and he's there all the time. And I thought, I can't do that. Would I put her in more danger? Would I put the kids in more danger? So I didn't do it."
Which you can understand, can't you? Because
absolutely,
the worst thing could have been a letter coming, even if it's sort of disguised. Yeah, he's probably standing over her when she opens her post because he's controlling and manipulating her, wants to know what's going on in her life. So, yeah, I doubt there's any way that she would have been able to see that information without him looking over her shoulder. And that, yeah, would have caused, I mean, probably what ultimately went on to happen.
Now, Terry did know about Bendel's immediate criminal past. I don't think she knew much of what he'd done before. And perhaps if she knew everything, she wouldn't have gotten into a relationship with him. But apparently she wanted to give him a chance to change. She felt that he deserved a relationship where he could be given the nurturing space to turn his back on his substance addictions. And she had a gut feeling her daughter's new partner was bad news and his alcohol and drug abuse fueled her worries. But although she became aware of his violent past, she still gave him a chance because that's what Terry wanted. And he actually told Angie that he had changed. He said to her he would never hurt Terry or the children. But the full truth of how right she actually was far worse than she could ever imagine. There was an inquest and a probation service inquiry, and the failings revealed were shocking. Angie Smith, on hearing the outcome of the findings, said it felt like being punched in the stomach. This case is horrific, but, you know, there's no doubt about that. But the fact that that is so much more concerning is that there's loads of information relating to Damon Bendel that was known to the probation service that could have prevented this. So the inquest identified that information regarding Damon Bendel was made known to the probation service. This included violent assault, injury of a partner, and an incident of possible child sexual abuse. But the information was not recorded clearly or prominently enough for subsequent probation staff to read or to be able to evaluate that in their risk assessments, to be able to use that information in their decision making.
I suppose you also have to rely on the criminal, the individual, Bendel, being honest with the probation officer and saying, I'm in a new relationship, this woman has two young children. Because if they don't know that, if they don't know...
They did know
right,
that.
Right, okay, well, yeah. That is completely different.
Because I do
then.
Agree with you yeah. there. But no, they yeah, knew where yeah. he was going to be living.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, they did know that, but the inquest did identify that domestic abuse and safeguarding checks that are supposed to be there to protect young people were either insufficient or wholly lacking at various stages of Damien Bendel's offender management. So at the time, they stated that the probation service was not actually conducting safeguarding checks in all cases where an offender will live with or have access to children. Like, surely the most vulnerable people in our society should be protected, but the probation service wasn't even doing those checks.
Yeah, and I don't know what the rules are, but it's not saying you can't, in this scenario, you can't have a relationship with a woman who's got children, but yeah, there just needs to be a real detailed risk assessment of that, some parameters put in place. And yeah, if that's not done, then those children are an incredible risk.
Yeah. And the inquest did clarify this was in part due to the systems for conducting those checks. Those systems were generally very strained. The probation service had to employ staff to make the checks from the police records because the police service itself was unable to do the checks and provide the information to the probation service within the right timeframes. So it was a system that was already under a lot of pressure. And I think what we'll find through this is there's lots and lots of elements where you can kind of think to yourself, gosh, I can understand this, even though it shouldn't have happened. And with that, I can kind of understand it. They can't, you know, the police are stretched enough. They can't do these checks. They can't provide this information. So it's onto the probation service. And the probation service are also so stretched. But it's just horrendous that this is one of the things that was missed.
And I think you're going to come on to talk about it a little bit, but I'm immediately thinking this is 2021. This is during the pandemic. I think it was still kind of raging on then. So there's lockdowns happening and yeah, not as much resource, I guess. So
yeah,
I am thinking,
exactly,
does that have an
impact? Thing to, yeah, that's the next thing that I've got, because I do think a lot of people will be thinking the same as you. Did the COVID lockdowns have an impact on this? But inspectors actually have stated that no. They found that none of the implemented ways of working as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic that were still in place in September 2021 directly impacted Bendel's case. So his most recent sentence, which was imposed in June 2021, didn't take place during a national lockdown. So some restrictions did remain at this point. And had his risk been correctly assessed as high risk, he actually still would have been directed to attend weekly probation appointments in person. So even with that, he still should have been had a risk factor of high. But there's still something to be said for this. So inspectors heard that the requirement for people to isolate during the COVID-19 pandemic contributed to the probation service having significant periods of absence from work. The transition to remote working and the implementation of the models of working at the time of the lockdowns did add pressure to their workloads, understandably, and the anxiety and uncertainty created by the COVID-19 pandemic had a detrimental effect on staff resilience. This kind of detrimental effect on their resilience was heightened because it was a unification period. There was kind of changes within the probation service at this already really challenging time. So whilst in black and white, no, there were no effects, actually the staff themselves were coming out of, or still in the middle of for a lot of people, an incredibly stressful and difficult time.
It does provide some context, doesn't it? Because mm-hmm. I'm kind of thinking when the inspectors are saying no, that there was no detriment to the process because of COVID, there's got to have been, like you say, because absence is increased, workloads are therefore increasing, people are moving to remote hybrid working, and then they've got these other changes coming in. So yeah, I'm not surprised that something went wrong. You would just have hoped it wouldn't have been as catastrophic as this.
So Pendle had a history of violent offending dating back to 2004. He was known to have had racist views. His past was filled with drug and alcohol-fueled offences. The most concerning, perhaps, was that he'd been accused of being a high risk to children due to a possible sexual incident in his past, but he'd been incorrectly classified as posing a medium risk of serious harm to the public, a low risk of harm to partners, and a low risk to children. And really, he should have been classed as high for all of those elements. And we'll go on to kind of explain where, you know, why that was, but he should not have been low risk to partners and children. Pendle's history and some allegations of domestic abuse against a former partner and inappropriate contact with a young girl in care were missed due to a failure to demonstrate sufficient professional curiosity, so the senior coroner at the inquest said. So that was an important piece of information that should have been prominently recorded in the probation report. And if it had been, he said, it appears to me inconceivable that Damien Pendle would not have been considered to be a high risk to children. If you've got something like that noted and it's put in the notes properly, anybody from the probation service should have then realised this was somebody who was high risk to children. But that contact log from the Child Sexual Exploitation Police Unit, which indicated a high risk of sexual harm to children, nor the 2019 assessment that found that Pendle posed a high risk of serious harm to people, neither of those were presented.
And the fact that he's got a history of, whether it's founded or just allegations, but allegations of inappropriate contact with a young girl in care, that's a young, vulnerable person. It's even worse because he's probably deliberately targeted her because she is most likely vulnerable if she's in the care system, and he knows that, I don't know what that inappropriate contact allegedly was, but there's a reason why he's targeted her specifically. So yeah, this is clearly somebody who's calculated, manipulative and willing to abuse.
Yeah. There was a report made about the curfew provisions for Pendle. So obviously when they were giving him the suspended sentence, they needed to put in place the provisions for his curfew. He was going to be on tag, and then he had to be in a property between certain times. And he stated that he would be under curfew at Terry's home address. This was noted as appropriate, and the report was written in such a way to indicate that the report writer had checked the suitability of the curfew address. But she hadn't actually done this. And the inquest heard that reports written by the same staff member also lacked evidence of the domestic abuse and safeguarding checks having been made, even though they were stated to have been done in the reports. So they were stating that they'd checked certain things. She hadn't checked them at all, and she put forward these reports as though this curfew was absolutely appropriate. What shocks me is that this wasn't even a disciplinary matter. So the inquest raised the question of whether the probation service had quite grasped the danger of these reports not being completed truthfully, because something as significant as these, you know, basically lies, they should have been a disciplinary matter. And this made me think of when me and you worked together and it was on a financial institution and it was on when I was on a counter serving people money. If you don't notice something like someone money laundering, you can still be prosecuted for failure to raise suspicions. It's not good enough to just kind of be like, I just didn't know what the risks were. I didn't know. So if that's the case, then why on earth is this person able to lie in her reports and it's not a disciplinary matter?
That is mad. You're absolutely right. Just for not being competent and not identifying that somebody's potentially attempting to launder money, you could actually end up in prison for that if you work for a financial institution and you're not clever enough to spot that despite the training that you've had, let alone turning a blind eye, which is kind of what's happening here. It's somebody who's deliberately falsifying records because they've not completed the due diligence and the checks required. I mean, that's even worse. So to not even have a disciplinary, let alone there to be more severe consequences, just blows my mind.
Yeah. And constantly on this, I'm going to be going back and forth, because on the flip side, the inquest did kind of raise the fact that these were very inexperienced staff who were wrongly allocated Damien Bendall's case when it was transferred to the East Midlands service, because he was from Swindon originally and they had to transfer his case across. These staff members were so inexperienced that they had insufficient domestic abuse and child safeguarding training. So actually, it's perhaps not that individual, it's the training that they received. I still think that there should be a disciplinary, that, you know, the probation service should be well aware that this is a disciplinary matter. This shouldn't be something that they just say, oh yeah, that was wrong, and nothing's followed up with. But I do understand how it could happen if you've got inexperienced staff and they're being allocated someone who's classed as low risk. He's actually high risk. They're not, you know, they're not in the right place to support this person and to support the public in dealing with this person.
It sounds like the processes and the organisation itself is sort of fucked, really, for want of a better word. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't seem quite fit for purpose. So it's easy to have a scapegoat and to blame one person, but actually there's wider problems there. So the fact that they'd had insufficient domestic abuse and child safeguarding training, surely anybody in the probation service, that's, I don't know, but common sense says to me that that's something you're going to come up against quite a lot. So that's probably really important above lots of other things. So there should have been training at least for that. And there was insufficient training that I can't get my head around.
Mm. And Damien Bendall was subject to an alcohol treatment requirement, but he missed either 4 or 5 of his mandatory appointments. I already think that that's quite shocking that they couldn't confirm for definite whether it was 4 that he'd missed or 5. So where's the record keeping? Because that's surely quite easy to prove. So he missed 4 or 5 of these mandatory appointments. However, the required non-attendance or attendance forms were not sent by the Substance Misuse Service to notify the probation service. So that type of non-attendance is non-compliance with the court-imposed treatment requirement. That should be considered by the probation service as something that infers a referral back to the courts. That's a breach of the court order. These non-attendance or attendance forms were not sent back in. So he should have been sent back to court.
He should have been recalled back into custody because this is the terms of his release from prison. Well, he's on a suspended sentence.
Yeah,
isn't
so he's not having to go to prison. These are the terms.
These are the terms on which you're not going to prison. So if you breach any of those, then of course you've got to be recalled immediately to prison, go into prison. So that is how serious it is if he's breaching it and not attending these alcohol treatment sessions. That needs to be documented. It's that important that if he's not doing it, he should be in prison. So somebody not filling out those non-attendance forms means that you've got somebody who should be in prison, not in prison, and then free to go and do whatever they are then going to go and do, which in this case is just beyond imagination. But
they
should have followed the process.
Yeah, it's another part to this that's just absolutely horrific. So the assessment on Bendall stated that he was a low-risk person to a partner. However, in his past, he had lived a lifestyle that included moving between the women in his life, such as his mum and his grandmother, stealing from them or otherwise using their money to pay his fines and accommodate him more generally. His previous partner had reported him and had requested a restraining order due to domestic violence. And if the information provided by his previous partner had been explored and recorded appropriately, it would have helped to kind of inform the assessment. But they kind of put him as a low risk, actually, when the investigation was, you know, took place after the murders. Inspectors found that the available evidence showed a medium risk of serious harm to a partner and not a low risk. And then we come on to Bendel's comments to the EMS field operative, so the person who was fitting his tag, the monitoring equipment for his curfew. So this is really, really awful. Damien Bendel told the operative, "If this relationship goes bad, I'll murder my girlfriend and the children." But that wasn't reported back by the field operative to her manager, nor to the probation service. He literally said that to her, and she just didn't even note it.
And weirdly to me, that is, it's a bit like when somebody talks about suicide, harming themselves. Sometimes it's there, it's almost a cry for help of, I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to control myself, so I need to articulate this and just kind of verbalize it and get it out there so that somebody can take control of this situation and get me some help. So I'm not sticking up for him at all, but I wonder if that was almost a cry for help of, I'm worried regarding what I might be capable of, so I'm just going to throw it out there because I need you to take me seriously. I'm worried that this could happen, so if I tell you, you'll make sure that that doesn't happen. I could be wrong, but I do feel like that was cry for help is perhaps not quite the right expression, but I wonder if that is him trying to get some intervention because he's worried that he is capable of this.
Or even maybe he's taking that responsibility away from himself because he's, well, I've said I would, and you've not even done anything about it, so I can carry on with how I am. It could be either way.
It's your fault now because I told you I'm capable of this.
Told you I would.
And you've not taken it seriously. Yeah, you didn't take it seriously, so you can have some of the blame at your door then. So this makes it more easy for me to do what I'm going to do.
The risk assessment stated that Bendel posed a medium risk of serious harm to the public. So Bendel had a known history of violence against Asian men. He'd committed robbery in 2010, attempted robbery with a knife in 2015, and arson in 2020. And these were all crimes against Asian men. He'd been explicit about his previous use of violence as a member of a white extremist organisation. He'd been recalled to prison previously for his reckless and unpredictable behaviour. This was exacerbated by substance abuse, which obviously is going to exacerbate it. And at the time of the order, there was no evidence of stability or sobriety in Bendel's life. He was known to be callous. He was known to enjoy violence and to use that in a controlled and instrumental manner. There were also unanswered questions about potential brain injury, which is completely unknown. That is not something that even the investigation was able to determine, but it's quite significant. So actually, in the last kind of inquiry, the inspectors found that actually Bendel posed a high risk of serious harm to the public, not a medium risk, which he was labelled as. In 2016, Bendel planned an attack on three prison officers, causing injuries which amounted to grievous bodily harm and two counts of assault, occasioning actual bodily harm. He stated he felt his use of violence was acceptable because he wanted a prison transfer and he'd been denied one. And previous probation officers and premises staff had recorded their discomfort in working with Bendel, saying they found him intimidating and manipulative. So he really did pose a high risk of serious harm to staff in custody, and actually a medium risk of serious harm to staff when in the community, when he's going to those meetings and those probation, kind of his substance classes and all of that. It's actually really would have been a medium risk of serious harm to those staff members.
And therefore steps could and should have been taken to protect those staff as well. So, I mean, I don't know what the processes are, but maybe two probation officers would have gone out and visited him if they were doing proper visits and stuff. So it is important to get that right, isn't it? That categorisation of low, medium, high, because different steps will be invoked with different categories to protect staff and the public.
Yeah. Although there was a police check of Terry Harris's address for previous domestic abuse instances that was conducted on the 16th of June, there was no other consideration given to the suitability of this address for Bendel's curfew, the safety of the relationship with Terry, or the well-being of her children. This again was taken for granted. Terry herself was not contacted for her views on this or on any occasion other than that. The probation service didn't check with Terry regarding her willingness or her ability to financially support and accommodate Bendel. And considering this was quite a new relationship, quite a recent relationship, she definitely should have been spoken to and given, well, I mean, anybody should, whether it's a long-term relationship or not. But if it's a, you know, long-term partner that you've been with forever and there's never been any issues, you can understand just assuming that it's okay. But she wasn't, apart from that one police check in June, there was no other consideration given that this potentially would not be suitable for Terry. And similarly, Bendel's mum was providing financial support. At this time, was paying one of Bendel's fines, which was imposed in 2015 alongside the prison sentence. Again, there was no consideration of whether this was appropriate, whether the arrangement was free of coercion. To be honest, they didn't even investigate whether it was affordable for Bendel's mum. It was just, that's what she's doing, and that was just known about, but just ignored. In August 2021, just over a month before the murders, reports noted that Bendel had disclosed that he had started smoking cannabis again. And the report stated he smokes in the morning and then smokes at night when the kids are asleep. And Bendel had also disclosed that he was drinking strong alcohol. Those are really clear indicators of an escalation in risk of serious harm, but these weren't followed up on, these weren't investigated. The probation service stated in their inquiry that, of course, there was a risk to the children in the home that Bendel would be staying in. But in marking the risk as low to children in the pre-sentence report, they'd failed to consider the impact that such a man would have on the lives of young children. So even without the potential sexual abuse in the past, the report stated, Bendel is an unpredictable and chaotic man with a history of substance abuse, serious violence, and extremist views. He reported that he had childcare responsibilities, including picking children up from school. It is implausible that Bendel had no negative effects on two children aged 11 and 13 years old. If records had been explored correctly, this assessment would have included police intelligence from March 2020 that Bendel posed a risk of sexual harm to girls. And inspectors found that at the start of the order, the correct risk assessment should have been high, a high risk of serious harm to children. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, even if you take away the potential sexual implications that he could have being in a house with an 11-year-old girl, this isn't someone that you should have around children. This is someone who is a chaotic,
unpredictable
drug addict, alcohol abuse. It's everything.
There's evidence that that's exacerbated for him specifically. There's evidence that his unpredictability, volatility is exacerbated when he's drinking and taking drugs. And they've got no proof that he's not doing those things.
No.
So, yeah, this is a guy that is capable of anything, really. And obviously, that's then what we see.
By the 17th of September 2021, so the Friday before Bendel murdered Terry and the three children, probation practitioners had evidence that Bendel was capable of committing serious harm and that this was potentially imminent. However, at this time, he was being managed by an inexperienced probation practitioner who couldn't identify this risk. In total, 51 failings were identified. 51 opportunities were missed that could have protected Terry, her two children, and her daughter's friend.
That is truly shocking.
I know. I just can't get over that 51 opportunities. It's such a heartbreaking case. And I really do hope that the probation service are taking on board all of the recommendations within the investigation. But each of those individual things, I think you can understand in isolation. It's the fact that they all, well, maybe not can understand. Some of them I cannot understand. If someone misses a court-mandated alcohol abuse class or whatever the word is, that non-attendance form should be sent. I do not understand how that is not done.
And you shouldn't be ticking stuff to say, I've done a risk assessment when you haven't.
Yeah, but I can kind of understand that a little bit, in that she possibly had 12 different cases that she was juggling, really stressed, and didn't see that there was any impact in saying, it's fine. And it clearly there is an impact, but I might be able to understand that a little bit more. But not telling your manager, at least, that someone who is being put on a tag to go and stay in their home with their girlfriend and children has just said, I will kill her if the relationship goes bad. How can you not say that and report that?
I mean, it's so easy to rip apart some of these institutions like social services in the past with cases we've covered, and now the probation service and the police, etc., etc. But the thing is, we don't often talk about cases where they've done a great job, because we take that for granted. And yeah, that's not really, it feels like that's not worthy of talking about. It kind of is, but yeah, we're only ever really looking at cases where it's gone wrong. So, you know, I don't want to trash the probation service, and certainly I don't want to trash individuals, because that's dangerous. But
and
I don't know,
be honest,
it's really hard to...
The media have ripped apart certain people who made mistakes,
which
and have purposefully not used any of their names or any of their proper information, because, you know, it's that one error that this person has made. I didn't think it was that bad. I didn't think he meant it. I didn't think it was an issue. Potentially, those four or five different meetings he missed were the same person not doing the forms, but potentially they were four or five different people, and each of them only missed one form, but they all just happened to have missed his. You just don't know.
And it's important work that they're doing, but none of us is perfect, and we all make mistakes, and that there's no malice in it, not for the majority of us. We're just human, so errors do happen, and they're going to be errors that have potentially grave consequences in this line of work. So it's not necessarily someone's fault, but this you're right, this could just be a catalogue of errors at the hands of lots and lots of different people, and a fundamentally flawed system is potentially what you're looking at here. And it's just all worked together to allow this to happen. And it's, it absolutely shouldn't have happened, but I would never want to pick apart an individual and say and go in at them like the press do and have done, like you said, in this case. I can see the headlines. I can imagine the headlines in some of those awful newspapers like The Sun, just trashing people, and that can have consequences. People can take their own lives as a result of that, and that's never, you know, no one would ever want that to happen, regardless of what's happened. So yeah, it's just so frustrating, and it's easy to want to pin it on somebody, but actually I think it's a fundamentally flawed system with fundamentally flawed processes.
Yeah, for people to not be trained well enough, for, you know, 51 different failings, that's not just going to be that one thing that someone didn't do. If it was the only thing that didn't get done, we wouldn't be sat here talking about this, because he wouldn't have been placed in her home. He probably would have actually had a custodial sentence, because the risk factors would have been seen, and if he didn't, he possibly would have been put under a lot more strict license kind of regulations and rulings. I think a lot of this has kind of made me think, well, what could you do then? Because you think you're protecting yourself, you think you're doing the right thing. Can we rely on these institutions? I think that's why I then thought, I really hope that the probation service are able to do better training, to give people, their staff members, more support. If they identify something that they're not sure of, just to be able to go to someone and say, you know, I've got this worry, I've got this thought. Is it something I should be worrying about or not? You know, some way to note things better.
Yeah, it's just going on to a different sort of part of this. I just wanted to kind of say about Connie as well. So Connie was Lacey's school friend, wasn't she? So she was the friend that was staying in the house, having a sleepover. And I do remember this now. Now that we've gone, now that you've gone into all the detail, it's really come back to me. And I think I remember that was one of the points that resonated with me at the time, was that I don't have children, but when you're a parent, you would entrust your child in the care of another family from time to time if they're having a sleepover at a friend's and all of that. And you just kind of take that for granted. And I can't imagine how awful Terry's mum must feel, for example, knowing that her daughter did everything within her power to provide a safe environment for Connie. And that happens, and I don't know, I hate to say it, but it's almost worse that this is then someone else's daughter brought into this, and and that Bendel has used this opportunity to annihilate this family when the daughter's friend happens to be staying over as well.
Yeah.
It's just that a real cruel additional layer to what he did.
And I don't know if it's the media choose what they want to report on and what they think is important or newsworthy, which I just absolutely hate because everybody should be. But obviously the news report on Bendel and the failings of the probation service, and they report on, you know, Angie's there speaking out very publicly, and there's really not much at all about Connie.
No.
Unless you do some real deep digging, which I'm not willing to do. This is a little 11-year-old, and actually if her family want privacy and that sort of thing, then I will give that to them. Her photo and her name has been released though as one of the victims, so you know, obviously they were clearly willing to allow that to be released by the press, but they haven't really said much at all. But that was definitely the bit that really hit me, was you know Terry has made the decision that she knows about these substance and alcohol issues, she wants to try and help this guy be better, do better. They must have had some sort of loving relationship, because she still stayed with him even though there was this controlling element. I don't think there was any sort of violence towards her that anybody had, at least that has been reported on or recorded. So whether this was completely unexpected to her or not, she still did know that she was bringing a man into the home that of her children, but they're her children. It's her kind of risks to mitigate and her life to make those decisions. But the other family just thought that Connie was going for a sleepover at Lacey's house. That's it. They surely wouldn't have known anything about Bendel and him.
No. And, you know, we're not getting in that territory of blaming anybody for any of this other than Bendel.
Oh, only Bendel. Absolutely. Yeah,
100%.
Bendel is 100% the only person that...
But I just... You are right. You can't hide from the fact that Terry has... Yeah, she's made that decision. And I would say there's a huge element of domestic abuse in the relationship. And, you know, she might have been under the impression that it was loving, but really she was probably being manipulated.
Absolutely,
and controlled.
Do you know what? That's a
really
good way to put it, because to her, I meant, that there would have been some sort of a loving relationship.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have been. And Bendel's not the sort of person who could actually have been in a loving relationship. She would have felt like she was, but it wouldn't have been.
But I think for Connie's parents they just did that in good faith, sending her to her friends for a sleepover. And it's no one's fault but Bendel's. But I just think for them, I don't know, it's just, I hate to say it, but it's almost worse.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of articulate, but I just.
That's how I felt when I was researching this.
We always just take those things for granted, that my child's going to be safe in that family home. You're just going to naturally think that. You're not going to question it. And Connie wasn't safe there.
But it's the same as when you
would never have been safe regardless of what happened.
No, because she still would have been exposed to Bendel, the person.
Yeah.
But it reminds me a little of when you hear of like a school trip and the coach has crashed and the children have died, and those parents, they send them off in the care of the teachers, in the care of the coach driver. You just don't ever expect that your child wouldn't come home from a sleepover or from school or whatever it is. You know, we hear we haven't ever covered a school shooting, have we, on the show? But you send your child to school, you just don't expect that anything would happen other than they go to school and they come home.
And it's just a normal thing to do.
It is. We've all been to sleepovers. I remember going to sleepovers as a child. My mum and dad would know the parents, but it was normal. It is normal.
And they didn't know the dynamics within that household, and why would they? So, you know, we probably had sleepovers within normal family environments, probably. But equally, my parents wouldn't have known that. I could have gone to a mate's and stayed over, and they might, you know, his parents might have had, or, you know, mum and partner, whatever, might have had an abusive relationship for all we knew. So I don't know. Yeah, it's absolutely no one's fault but Bendel's, but it just makes my brain tick a little bit of how far do you go with mitigating that risk of entrusting your child in somebody else's care that actually you don't know them.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of touch a little bit on Claire's law as well, because I do think it's an incredibly important and valuable thing that we now have, that you can get in touch with the police and say, I've got into a relationship with someone and I need to know if they've got a domestic abuse, any sort of allegations or any criminal past. But I did think it was incredibly frustrating and heartbreaking in this case that he was living at that house. He had been mandated to stay there by the courts. So any post that came through, it could have come with like a police stamp on the envelope. It could have said where it's come from. It might have come in a plain white envelope, but we don't know how controlling was he. Was he opening her post? Like you said, did he stand there and watch her whenever she saw, did anything?
It could have been opening it, earlier. Like you say.
He could have been opening it.
Yeah.
So Terry's mum and the parents of another person who, I cannot remember her name, but someone else who lost their life, but Claire's law wasn't quite able to fully protect them.
Oh, no.
They are campaigning and have been campaigning for a bit of a change in that, so that anybody can put through a request to know about someone's past.
And it's just thought, so difficult though. I don't know how possible that is, and that opens up the
floodgates.
What
are your thoughts though? Because if that person has got that in their past, and say, for example, I want to do that check for my daughter, I'm doing it in good faith. So I'm doing it to try and find something out, fine. But what if it was, I've started working with you and then I find this out about you and I can use it against you? I think it could be really dangerous if anybody
could put
through.
It's open to abuse.
It's open to abuse.
I wish there was an easy way around it. I personally can't see that there is, and they're going to have to give that information to the specific person. So in this case, Terry, but like you say, there's just so many challenges with that. If they're in an abusive relationship or a coercively controlling relationship, if they send it via email, their emails are going to be intercepted by this person. So yeah, I can't see a way around it, but I just think it's so open to abuse that it can't be that anybody can request that information about anybody, because it would be abused.
But then, playing devil's advocate, if you have abuse, you know, you've had some sort of charges or arrests in the past, that could well be, you know, your name could be on records anyway. So actually, if it then helps to protect somebody, would that not be actually beneficial for society, that anybody could check and know?
But then what if it hasn't been reported? What if it hasn't been reported? It's confidential information. And anyone can get it, but I could get that information about a celebrity. I could put one in about a celebrity.
That's true.
And then I know something about them, and I tell lots of people about that. Is that fair?
And
if that celebrity has done something bad and they're trying to move on, and they've paid their penance,
meant to be rehabilitated, and they've paid their price and they've done the time. Yeah. So. Yeah,
it's just such a messy one. I don't think you'll ever kind of win in terms of finding a solution to that. It's a real shame, because I was like, how is this going to work? How is Terry going to get that information securely and safely? I couldn't see a way that she would have. So I completely understand her mum, Angie, was not going ahead with it in the end. It was the right thing for her to not do that. It could have brought things to a head more quickly than it actually did.
I think it's very frustrating that she couldn't get Terry to do this, but to nominate her address. And I think that's really sad as well. Obviously, there may well still be the answer of no, it has to go to your registered address, which they know because it's on the court documents for his curfew and all of this. So potentially that still wouldn't have even solved anything. But you can see that Angie really wanted to find out, to try and at least give Terry more information and give her more fuel to want to leave. She just sounded like a really nice person who just really wanted to do some good for somebody and give someone the benefit of the doubt and give them a second chance, which is so admirable. And it breaks my heart then that he then repaid that in the most evil way possible. And then you've got John Paul and Lacey and Connie caught up in the whole thing as well.
Yeah, it was a truly shocking crime. I do remember at the time, and I do remember just thinking, oh my God. And it was the fact that Connie was there as well. This was different to other family annihilations that we've seen.
And
yeah. For me, it just added that additional layer of cruelty. Yeah, it was just terribly upsetting and terribly shocking at the time. And still is, of course. But yeah.
And I don't even have like a happy note to end on, I'm afraid. It's just a really horrible case that's really got to me this week. It's so, so sad.
Yeah, some and most of them are like that, some more than others. And yeah, I can completely understand why it's an absolute tragedy, and it was avoidable. So
yeah,
it is incredibly frustrating
too. It was completely inevitable that something was going to happen. When you look at the risk factors, he was going to do something. And sadly, this was like the worst possible example of what he would have gone on to do.
I think the only positive you can take out of any of this and us covering it is just highlighting that Clare's Law does exist, and that will absolutely work for lots of people who are getting into a relationship with a new partner or are in a relationship. Maybe they're not living together. Maybe there aren't elements of coercive control
exactly. And
they can safely receive that information. Yeah. So I think highlighting Clare's Law is always a good thing. So there is something there. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us this week, guys. Thank you for joining us for this case. And we'll be back next week with another episode.
We'll see you then. Bye.